Blog Talk Radio.
Bring
Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Sunday, August 1st, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of our program. Later on, we'll be coming up with our Pan-African Newswire report, and we'll review some of the dispatches on issues covered over the last month involving developments in Ethiopia, Haiti, Cuba, the United States, among other topics. We want to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is a 7-day-a-week and 24-hour-a-day electronic media service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people around the world. In the second hour, we begin our month-long commemoration of Black August, which recognizes the legacy of resistance by African people to enslavement, colonialism, capitalism, imperialism, racism, and neocolonialism. We look back at the history and significance of the Haitian Revolution through a rare archival interview with C.L.R. James that was conducted in 1970. Finally, we review some of the leading news stories in Africa as well as around the world. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. So stay tuned. We'll take a musical interlude, and let's listen to the music of the TPOK Jazz Orchestra.
Kabisa ngobya mokili Sherilina banda kakae,
señorita yo te quiero,
hasta lelona jali bayoe,
señorita yo te quiero,
en aliwana jali se bayoe,
señorita yo te quiero,
Sherilina banda kakae,
señorita yo te quiero,
hasta lelona jali bayoe,
señorita yo te quiero,
en aliwana jali se bayoe,
señorita yo te quiero. Señorita yo te quiero,
hasta lelona jali bayoe,
señorita yo te quiero,
en aliwana jali se bayoe,
señorita yo te quiero,
Sherilina banda kangae,
señorita yo te quiero,
hasta lelona jali bayoe,
señorita yo te quiero,
en aliwana jali se bayoe,
señorita yo te quiero.
Marisha de Sherilina.
Thank you. kisasa Colonel Bangana Mobongisi monene ya vile ya kisasa
Colonel Bangana Otia motema po bongisa mboka
Colonel Bangana Mobongisi monene ya vile ya kisasa Colonel Bangana Mobongisi monene ya vile ya kisasa
Colonel Bangala, mon bundi monene ya délicance juvenile.
Colonel Bangala, mon bongisi monene ya vile ya kisasa. Colonel Bangala, mon bongisi monene ya vile ya kisasa.
Colonel Bangala, mon petisi monene ya mobulu na kisasa.
Colonel Bangala. Mobongisi monene ya vile ya kisasa Colonel Bangala Mobongisi monene ya vile ya kisasa
Oh Colonel Bangala Totia matema mbo silisa mobulo yo
Colonel Bangala Mobongisi monene ya vile ya kisasa Colonel Bangala Mobongisi monene ya vile ya kisasa Colonel Bangala, Mobongisi monene ya vile ya kisasa. Colonel Bangala, Mobongisi monene ya vile ya kisasa.
Colonel Bangala, Mobundi monene ya délicance juvenile.
Colonel Bangala, Mobongisi monene ya vile ya kisasa. Colonel Bangala. Mobongisi monene ya vile ya kisasa
Makalamba, naziona maina komisiyo nisanga lelo na komi mabe mokolo wana yali wana koma kinenda pomba.
Na longwi vivi mama. Na komi alobe.
Gana poka mwateo, lelo na lobi ezala ki viva vivi oti yogo. Lelo yodi to boya niye, eko mina miswa batonga imobali ya uye. Mokili makalamba, nazio na maina komi siyo netanga. Lelo na komi mabe, mokolo wana yali wana koma kinenda pompa. Ah, ne croyez jamais à ces belles paroles. Dès que le jour paraît, tout le charme s'envole. Bomba, bomba, mabe mingi aniye. Nazi mwazi, miso mike, zolo moke ya lolendo. Bomba bomba mabe mingi anie, na yebisi yona boyo. Nazi mwazi, miso mike, zolo moke ya lolendo.
Ki mama na kanisa kiteyo koko sangai diyo siko yonga na moniye no kolobi balobi nagaye nalingi na yeba badalelo yo ozali se vanga motema. Bona lingiteo, papa kola, gai bozo bawa. Mama na kanisa kiteyo koko sangai diyo siko yonga damoniye no kyolobi balobi nangaye nalingi na yeba badale loyo ozali se wanga motema pona lingi teo papa kola ngai bozoba limalu nalingi oyebisa ngai naboyi nanga koyoka songi songi ya bato limalu talanga se mobalie moto nyonso akobungaka moto nyonso akosalaka o limalu nalingi oyebisa ngai naboyi nanga koyoka songi songi ya bato mama yokelanga bayodi ye oyokisanga soni te ngai se bayo ye
Thank you. nchi yo miho Mia bueni tape contesto Avia grandes cafetales Lluvia hito fervor Los pajelos en el monte Uno es su canto de silla
Telegram, Mosika na Bazanga Makani Singa Inzoto. motema kabi bolingo diero. Confiance na pesaki ata kobanga te bolingo kangi matoyo. Anga soninga kobolingo na ebana. Lobi na kozonga mobembe zanini wate bolingo na kozonga. Awadi yo bomi bolingo. Okosamba atanga miswanzambe bolingo okosamba. Confiance nga na pesaki lelo sabotewo. Okoyiba pona mbongo baluka kana mwinda teo mama okoyiba. Zaire pona bilongyo. Okosamba zoto pamba bolingo soki okufeli na via kisasa. Okosamba nako kapeko libisa te na ndenge osabo te nako kwela.
Français?
Moi pas connais français. Tu reconnais?
Oye bilingala?
Moi t'es pas, yébite lingala t'es.
Allez, viens, on va prendre un verre, allez.
Moi bois pas. Tu bois beaucoup?
Ah ah, les pondis, moi comprends pas français. Ah ah, Brazzaville, moi comprends pas français. Ah ah, Ilonto, moi parle pas lingala. Ah ah, Dizavi, moi comprends pas lingala. Ah,
beaucoup et tu bois beaucoup. Tu bois beaucoup et tu bois beaucoup.
Tu comprends français,
toi pas comprends français.
Oye bilingala,
naye bite, naye bite oh, naye bite. Lingala te oh, lingala te.
Tu commences à y longtemps,
tu bois beaucoup.
Jusqu'à vis-à-vis,
tu bois beaucoup. Tu bois beaucoup et tu bois beaucoup.
Oye bilingala,
naye bite, naye bite oh, naye bite, naye bite oh, naye bite, lingala te oh, lingala te.
Tu commences à y longtemps,
tu bois beaucoup.
Il y a un bateau paradis, Teresina de mi amor, mi abaila ta ta ta.
Thank you.
Nalinga kina lo batalu mumbate Lelo la verite ou rien que la verite Mokoto wa kitane Mokoto
Lumumba Giro Nacional
Bakanga Kinga Bandeko Bapikisa Kinga Bandeko Kombo ya Lumumba La Lumba Mokutu wa tibi, nalubi naluba Nakima kinda kunanga bandeko Balinga kinda lobata lumumbate Lelo la verite, urenge la verite Mokutu wa kitani, lumumba Oh, mokutu, landa zela mboyo kana kinda lumumba
nova.
Oh,
sala nini bongo na motema ho bosana de tushaki bitoma si oro gogo baloka oro zambero gogo baloka oro mobale amesa kante de vape baloka oro bitoma si oro
Nakati ya pongi maye bani kole kangai na misoi mawe La vie a tango, yo patron angai. Kanisa mwasi na banango omawa. Tango na zala kiko teka sikaletio. Nazwa kameya na boko loko bana.
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, August 1st, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit, and we just heard the Pan-African classical music of Franco and the TPOK Jazz Orchestra, music from 1964. Yes. And right now we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. And the Pan-African Newswire is a 24-hour a day, 7-day a week media service. And in the headlines for today, there are a series of articles and reproductions of radio broadcast, the Pan-African Journal, this program, worldwide radio broadcast from yesterday, July 31st, is already posted on the Pan-African Newswire. Several days ago, we published an article on the contributions of SNCC veterans, Gloria Richardson and Bob Moses. And those articles can be read on the Pan-African Newswire. And there are many other entries that cover just this last past month of July. You can read some 23 entries, which represents work done during the month of July by the publisher and editor of the Pan-African Newswire. And we want to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998, and since then, it has published thousands upon thousands of articles and dispatches in numerous newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, all you have to do is go to our website, and that's at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to the Pan-African Journal, today's Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast, all you need to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network, and that's at blogtalkradio.com / Pan-African Journal, and that's blogtalkradio.com / Pan-African Journal. Not only can you have access to today's program for Sunday, August 1st, 2021, but well over 1,000 other archived editions of the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast. And also, these programs can be shared with other potential listeners. All you need to do is copy and paste the links in the emails and send those emails out to other potential listeners. You can also post the links of the programs on blogs and websites. The links can also be shared through social media networks such as Facebook and Twitter. And this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and we'll have a musical interlude, and we'll be back with more of our program for this week.
Sometimes Sometimes I'm up, sometimes I'm down. I can't make my living around this town. Cause tricks ain't walking no more. I said tricks ain't walking no more. And I've got to make my living, don't care where I go. I need shoes on my feet, clothes on my back. Get tired of walking these streets all dressed in black. But tricks ain't walking no more. I said tricks ain't walking no more. Four or five good tricks standing in front of my door. Please help me, they look on my lead. Four or five good tricks is all the money I need. But tricks ain't walking no more. Tricks ain't walking. Tricks ain't walking no more. And I can't get a break, don't care where I go. I got a store on the corner, selling stuff cheap. I got a market across the street where I sell my meat. But tricks ain't walking no more. Tricks ain't walking no more. And I can't get a break, don't care where I go. This way of living so is hard, ducking and dodging the Cadillac squad. But tricks ain't walking. Tricks ain't walking no more. I said tricks ain't walking no more. And if you think I'm lying, follow me to my door.
Welcome back, and that was the music, classic blues music of Lucille Bogon, with the tune entitled Tricks Ain't Walking No More. And we are here at the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, August 1st, 2021. And this is Black August once again. And, of course, August is a commemoration of the struggle of African people against enslavement, racism, colonialism, neocolonialism, capitalism, and imperialism. And of course, this holiday was largely developed by political prisoners and prisoners of war inside the United States during the 1990s. So therefore, let's move into some of this resistance history. C.L.R. James, the author of the classic and pioneering work, The Black Jacobins, on the history of the Haitian Revolution from 1791 to 1804, was interviewed in 1970 by veteran radio host Sturge Turkle in Chicago. And we're going to play that interview, a very important audio document. Let's listen in about the Haitian Revolution.
Christopher Columbus landed first in the New World at the island of San Salvador, and after praising God, inquired urgently for gold. The natives, Red Indians, were peaceable and friendly, and directed him to Haiti, a large island, nearly as large as Ireland, rich, they said, in the yellow metal. He sailed to Haiti. One of his ships being wrecked, the Haitian Indians helped him so willingly that very little was lost, and of the articles which they brought on shore, not one was stolen. The Spaniards, the most advanced Europeans of their day, annexed the island, called it Hispaniola, and took the backward natives under their protection. They introduced Christianity, forced labor in mines, murder, rape, bloodhounds, strange diseases, and artificial famine by the destruction of cultivation to starve the rebellious. These and other requirements of the higher civilization reduced the native population from an estimated 500,000, perhaps 1,000,000, to 60,000 in 15 years.
And thus it is that Dr. C.L.R. James, a very distinguished scholar, reads the first two paragraphs of his prologue, a remarkable book, a classic, The Black Jacobins, which deals with the Toussaint Louverture-led black slave rebellion in San Domingo 2 years after the French Revolution. In these two paragraphs, Dr. James, your style of writing, of course, is a very salubrious one indeed, but the bite, the irony, and the truth, you might say, of white man in all these years, of Western civilization, so-called, in these two paragraphs, you've almost essentialized it.
Yes, I think so, and I wrote it quite naturally. I didn't have to search, but I am a West Indian, and we in the West Indies are very much aware of the contrast between what the white man says and what he does, because we are Western civilized in our orientation, so we are aware of all the things he's saying, much more than people who speak a different language or live a different type of civilization.
This very point you make, which you point out, Professor James is now visiting professor at the Northwestern University. The fact that you're West Indian, this has always been a fascinating historical point, isn't it?
We think
among the leaders and the whole black liberation movement through the years have been West Indians.
Yes, we have had a whole lot of them. We have had Marcus Garvey. We have had Aimé Césaire, the poet, with that magnificent poem on Africa in which he stated the question of negritude. We have had René Marin, who won the Prix Goncourt with the book Batuala on Africa. We have had
George Padmore,
Marcus Garvey, as I said, and we have had, there's no doubt about it, that Malcolm X's mother was a West Indian, and that had something to do with it, and Stokely Carmichael was born and grew up there as a boy. I also took some part. I believe it is something that is worthwhile, and I know and feel myself as a West Indian as Padmore was.
It's as though two cultures are fused, in a sense.
Yes, we are not admitted completely into the Western culture, but we have all the possibilities of developing it. So on being kept back at home, we went abroad and made the best use of both the opportunities of education and the impulse towards freedom which we felt in the island. That is the reason why the West Indians have done so well. And I would like to add this, that Fidel Castro and the Cubans are not all black people. Fidel isn't black at all. But the attitude of the revolution and what they are doing is essentially a West Indian revolution, similar to what Toussaint Louverture did.
Yes, so we come, in fact, you have an appendix to your book, an epilogue. You wrote the book in 1938, how remarkably prescient and prophetic Professor James' book is, because he dealt with the nature of Africa and the possible independence movements back then. But the epilogue is from Toussaint Louverture to Castro. Now, Toussaint Louverture, and it's imperative, of course, that white people know this. More blacks do, or we know that younger blacks are aware of this. I had difficulty finding this book, by the way, in white bookstores. I found it at the Ellis Bookshop on South College, which is significant in itself, I think.
I think the book now is being sold and read everywhere.
Yes.
I think the movement on the whole, it is being read and studied in universities predominantly white in the United States. That is a fact. Although it's the black movement that has given it the great impetus.
Perhaps we should dwell upon the nature of this book, and it's a terribly important one. It's the Black Jacobins, the subtitle, Toussaint Louverture and the San Domingo Revolution. Now, here you describe a scene. Spaniards came, the French, the British. They found a great deal of profit to be made in the West Indies, San Domingo, Haiti. And
it was the wealthiest colony in the world at the time, not only in the West Indies.
And so, but it could only be done. You describe, of course, the slave trade and the nature of the slave ships and the incredible brutishness. So the question is, how could a people, the black people in this case, the Africans, and this, well, I'll ask you about the mulattoes in a moment, the Creoles, how could they survive is the question. This is the key.
The question is this. Number one, they were a people, obviously, who had basically a very fine physique. Otherwise, they would have been wiped away by the sheer objective circumstances of the Middle Passage and their lives. They had a fine physique, and secondly, which is a most important point, they obviously were a highly civilized people. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been able to be integrated into the sugar production in the way that they were and learn as rapidly as they did the language and all the techniques of Western civilization. They were civilized people in Africa, and today people are more and more recognizing that even when they were slaves in Africa, they were slaves of a certain organized society. That is what must be remembered about the West Indian. And he was more fortunate than he was in the United States because the islands were small, immensely concentrated. The sugar plantation had many of them living together, so they were closely connected. And this backbone of civilization in Africa and African physical strength, and then having to learn the elements of Western civilization, made them what they did and what they have become.
So we come to several points that Dr. James raises, and again, the question of submerged history or suppressed history, that there was a highly developed, and Basil Davidson, among others, points
this out. Basil Davidson is doing a lot of that work, and that work is very important, and I'm very glad that Basil Davidson is doing it, because I have to say there is a tendency to criticism, sharp criticism of people who are whites because they are white. And Basil Davidson is a white man who would be an adornment to any black university.
But in his books, whether it be The Lost Cities of Africa, others, he speaks, and indeed many anthropologists now are discovering, there was a highly developed civilization before the slave ships came.
Yes, not only that, the man who I know has carried that to the highest point is Professor George Roig. He used to be at Rochester, and he's now professor of sociology at Washington University in St. Louis. And he's doing some work on that subject, which is the very finest and most developed that I know. I myself am writing something, and most of my work is based not only on previous knowledge, but on what he and I have worked out together.
Before I ask you further about the book, we go into the book, we should point out to the audience that Professor James is a historic figure. I hope you don't mind my saying this. Not a museum. Professor James was an acquaintance of Nkrumah. He had met him when you discovered him, when he was going to the University of Pennsylvania. He was a friend of Dr. Du Bois. Was a friend of George Padmore, a remarkable figure too little known to...
A close ally of George Padmore. I used to know Marcus Garvey, too.
You knew Marcus Garvey.
Marcus Garvey came to Trinidad sometime about 1928. He had already been sent away from the United States. And I was a reporter, and I went and interviewed him and followed him around where he spoke. He was a tremendous man.
You probably are one of the few living people, I would guess, who knew Marcus Garvey personally.
Yes, I knew Marcus Garvey. I interviewed him somewhere about 1928.
Perhaps this is worth dwelling on, the role of Marcus Garvey. Here's a man who's been ridiculed to a great extent, and yet he made people aware, did he not, this West Indian?
I believe the intellectual origin of the black movement must rest with Dr. Du Bois. A man with a range of scholarship, practical activity, and ambition for the development of humanity, which is not exceeded by anybody in the 20th century. But his chief concern was to appeal to and get in contact with intellectuals, historians, organizers, etc. When Du Bois was finished, Garvey began, so to speak, and Garvey made black emancipation something popular, which it had never been before. So both of them, although they may have had conflict, they filled political roles. Du Bois made it an intellectual discussion, posed the question. Garvey made it a popular question. When Garvey was finished, everybody knew there was a black question. Both white people knew and black people all over the world knew. And that is what Garvey did, despite the mistakes that he made. That is to his great credit.
And Garvey's name was known throughout the black world. In Africa, too, they knew of Marcus Garvey.
And also throughout the white world. Garvey had made everybody, black and white, understand that the black man was sleeping no longer. He was on his way. That is his great contribution.
Here again, a West Indian, And so we return to this moment that with which your book begins. Here was a colony profitable to the colonist, to the absentee landlords, the powers, people being used, abused, yet surviving. Now, something happened in France. Now, in 1789 was a French Revolution. Therefore, it had a certain impact. How did word come to San Domingo?
For one reason, people used to go up and down, but the French whites discussed the doctrines of the French Revolution with the utmost freedom. And there were white people from France who asked them, aren't you worried a bit that you should discuss these things before these black people? But they paid no attention to the blacks. They looked upon them as some sort of animal. A white woman used to undress before the black slaves as if they were a horse or a dog. They looked upon them as nothing. And they discussed these things very freely. And people from France asked them, but aren't you nerve talking? They didn't bother, but the blacks were listening.
Ah, what is interesting about this, what makes Professor James' book so contemporary, is this very point you just made. Often there is a woman working as a domestic in the home of a white mistress, you know, and she's talked about many, tell me this, friends of mine who worked as domestics, elderly women, who say that they know everything about this person, and the person knows nothing about her because that, they talk in front of her as though she were furniture.
That is a fact. That is a fact. That is a fact. You see, and a great deal of that is due to the fact that the black man is looked upon as a barbarous African, but he has had to learn the language. That is very important. He has had to learn the European language. So today in the Caribbean, he speaks English, French, or Spanish. And he's equally a master of all of those,
and so
those languages.
He's learned these languages. He's learned far more, indeed, than the white master knew, to survive. And so we come to many other aspects in your book, the nature of survival itself. Sometimes it's clowning. Sometimes it's pretending not to know in order to survive. And behavior different, black people among blacks, different than, say, in front of the white.
That is quite true. But the thing that I emphasize in regard to the Caribbean islands and regard to the San Domingo Revolution and the Cuban Revolution is this. The islands are rather small, judging on a world scale. The population is immensely concentrated. The type of industry where there is some is sugar or scraps of modern industry which develop a highly civilized population. And in, for example, Trinidad, the island I come from, Barbados and Jamaica, we have the extraordinary advantage of having newspapers, papers, television, radio, etc., from Britain, from the United States, and from Canada. The opportunity of being in touch with the advanced centers of civilization is very
good. So
great.
Then the people were au courant with all aspects of life.
The people are aware. They just have to pay $2 or $3 a month, and they get a radio, and they hear everything that's going on.
Now, going back to this time, something was happening then at this moment in France, the revolution. 2 years later, something broke out in San Domingo, and we learned of a man named Toussaint Louverture. But before that, now, was there an attempt by the colonists to split the people? After all, there were mulattoes, there were Creoles, and there were the blacks.
Yes, the San Domingo Revolution began, the black revolution, because of the fierce struggle that was carried on between the San Domingo whites and the mulattoes who owned property, and some of them were educated. And after seeing the ferocity of that violence, the blacks themselves entered. They entered as a result of the conflict between San Domingo whites and San Domingo mulattoes. In the same way as the masses of France intervened because of the conflict between the nobles, the aristocracy, and the bourgeoisie, this went on, and then the masses came in. The same thing happened in San Domingo.
So a parallel was working both
parallel
ways.
Was
a remarkable
working. As
parallel.
A matter of fact, I'm very much struck by the tremendous parallels between the development in San Domingo and the developments in France. Much of my book pays careful attention to that, and I believe there are more parallels to be found later as we study both the French Revolution and the San Domingo Revolution.
So there was a question of paradox involved, a question of contradiction involved. You point out the French Revolution was, in a sense, bourgeois.
It was.
Taking over, knocking off the... At the same time, slave trade was part of their...
Yes,
nice.
The money that the bourgeoisie got that made them what they were, and as Jaurès says, gave them the feeling for liberty, that came from the slave trade. It's a very sharp contradiction. Now, the second paradox that I'm concerned with is that the sugar plantation was a very severe and demanding mode of labor, but it also concentrated the blacks and gave them some element of social civilization, some feeling of unity, and enabled them to learn fundamentally many aspects of Western civilization. So that this sugar plantation was at the same time the most degrading and at the same time a very civilizing effort on the part of the black people.
Again, paradox. The degrading nature of the work, the exploitation, at the same time, communication. Because of the constant contact.
Constant contact, and also the sugar plantation produced sugar, and the food that they ate came from abroad, the sugar was sent abroad, and so forth, so that they had education not only in what was going on around them and the close relation with their masters, but the sugar plantation was intimately connected with foreign developments and finance and so forth, and all that the slaves learned.
So the window now was being opened. The window, awareness was occurring, and once that happens, people can no longer be the same.
And the moment the French Revolution began, because what is important about the San Domingo Revolution, which has made it the most successful, the only successful slave revolt in history, is the fact that they were slaves. They had these elements of civilization in them, but they were able to use the doctrines and ideas of the French Revolution and apply them, these ideas, to their own situation. So they had not only a physical basis, contact with society, but they had a new ideology. That's what they were, liberty, equality, fraternity, all that meant to them, the republic, and so on.
So again, perhaps the crowning paradox is the fact that it was the bourgeoisie that were factors in the French Revolution, and also profiting the slave trade, but because of what they did, the window was now opened to the black slaves as well as the colored slaves.
And they learned they took it over and made it something for themselves.
And so the time was ripe then for a certain figure or group of figures.
Yes,
on the
basis of that objective development and the spread of ideas, there emerges this remarkable man. It's difficult to say that the revolution made him, but he made the revolution, but the interplay between them is such that it's difficult to distinguish.
And here we come to a man who's been a slave for 45 years,
yes.
Toussaint Louverture.
Yes.
And he comes at this moment, about 1791 or so.
Yes. However, more important is the fact that the Abbé Raynal had written a famous book on the situation in the East and the West Indies. And he had said in that book, in a magnificent gesture, that the time was coming when some revolutionary person would relieve the slaves of the burdens from which they were suffering. And what is most fantastic, that book came into the hands of Toussaint Louverture. And he read repeatedly this passage in which the Abbé Raynal, I'm sure he was just a revolutionary intellectual, he just said, someday somebody would arise. And Toussaint kept on saying, someday somebody should arise. And he kept on thinking that someday somebody should arise. And the moment the revolt started in San Domingo, he said, I am the person now. That is a very strange business.
Now, something was happening in France. You mentioned that Diderot, there were writings against slavery.
That is before the revolution, yeah. The encyclopedia, yes.
There are writings, but very often, I think you point this out in the case of Robespierre, that it was the word rather than the deed that was being attacked.
Because to abolish slavery meant a revolution. A tremendous revolution, not only in San Domingo, but in France. And they had reached 1793, and the days of May 1793, and they had reached this spring of 94 before they abolished slavery.
So now the word had come. The man had come, and his colleagues, now the word. Were they, and for 12 years now, the battle raged, the revolution, with pressures back and forth. Were the colonists, wholly, now we come to the question of awareness or lack of awareness, were the absentee landlords or the colonists themselves?
Now, the colonists began by joining the revolution because the ancient monarchy had what is called the exclusive, and by that means they dominated the economy. So the colonists began by joining the revolution. But afterwards they saw that the revolution in France was assisting the black people and saying, at any rate, if you are fighting for freedom, you should have it, etc. Whereupon the colonists, to a large majority, offered the colony to the British. They offered it to the British. They were ready to get rid of King and all this loyalty. They told them if slavery was not matter to them.
Yeah.
And so they offered it to the British, and the British came to get it. But they were defeated by Toussaint Louverture and the Black Army.
So we have here again, we come back to your very opening two paragraphs you read in the prologue, the question of the coin,
the question of gold,
of
the property,
the wealth,
the production, the control of it.
So I think what's bone deeply powerful about Dr. James' book, The Black Jacobins, is it deals with the reality of today, too. Though you deal with a time 100 and almost 200 years ago, and you didn't say that there's lip service very often offered, but until the reality phase that may concern property itself, then a shift occurs in the case of the colonists.
I was able to write this book because I was taking part in London and thereabouts with George Padmore, Jomo Kenyatta, and various others. I had been friendly. I got to know Nkrumah. And we were living this life. In other words, the French Revolution, the Revolution of San Domingo, was to us a forecast of what would take place in Africa. So this book is closely the result of the kind of activity we were carrying on, both with the Marxist movement, with the Black movement, and with the Labour Party and various others in Europe. The book is the result of a collaboration of a lot of people.
So it really is a fusion of past and present.
It's a fusion.
So you wrote about the past, writing about present and future.
And if you read the book carefully as you will see that all through I am concerned with the effect of what I am writing on Africa.
Yes.
Yes.
Even have, if we come to another aspect, and this connects with the revolution itself, Toussaint Louverture, voodooism, the very fact that this had to be done secret too, because how could black people be Christians, or would make no sense, equal to the white, the colonists?
They stuck to their voodooism because it formed a secret means of communication. But when the revolution actually took place, Toussaint and his officers were very severe against voodooism. They thought it was a backward means. But undoubtedly, I have no doubt as time goes on, that voodooism, not only before 1791, but afterwards, was a secret means of communication between the Haitians.
The slaves in America, the spiritual had a double meaning,
yes.
So the gatherings.
They were very close to Africa, you see, because many of the slaves who made the revolution had made the Middle Passage. So they had their voodooism. Well, they
now, had. A question, because your book raises these questions, which makes it so fascinating a work, too. The role of the French working people, masses now, at the time, the French Revolution and after, what effect this was having on the revolt elsewhere? We naturally think of today, America and Vietnam, in a sense. You see.
No, I think this much. First of all, the French Revolution was a bourgeois revolution in that it resulted in the displacement of the feudal elements by the bourgeoisie, and the bourgeoisie took over. But the fact remains that the bourgeoisie would not have been able to carry that revolution to its success unless the masses of the French people, the sans-culottes, had done it for them. The sans-culottes didn't win many, but they were so hostile to the regime that they carried the bourgeois revolution to its complete end. And also in San Domingo, the revolt there meant that the black soldiers were able to defend that wealthy colony against the British, Spaniards, and the rest of them. So that they help one another. And at the high peak of the revolution in France, that was the time when the French revolutionary forces declared freedom for blacks everywhere. So the two of them were working together.
Now, were there attempts, I think you point this out in the book too, there was a great ambivalence on the part of mulattoes to many, many cases.
Yes, the mulattoes were an intermediate class. It has nothing to do with their color or their blood or the mixture of blood. It is that they were not closely allied with the rich whites, but they were rich people, and they were allied in a way with the blacks. They were partially British blacks. So in between there, they were a typical intermediate class and wobbled both sides. Now they would go with this one and the other. And the ultimate victory in San Domingo was won when the mulattoes joined completely with the blacks to finish up with the French invasion.
Now we come to several people in Toussaint's life. You mentioned Abbé Raynal. And a remarkable man named Santonax.
Santonax was a Jacobin. He was a right-wing Jacobin. But there was something about him. He came out to San Domingo being sent by the government more than once. And although he made mistakes and things and so forth, he was a man completely devoted to the emancipation of the black people. And he taught them literacy. He taught them revolutionary songs. He taught them Latin and Greek stories and education, the doctrines of the revolution. And he told them, you have your guns, keep them. If at any time anybody tells you to give up your guns, they mean to restore slavery. Santonax was a bit uncertain as to what was taking place in France, but in regard to San Domingo, 50 years after, black slaves still remembered him because he had devoted himself completely to black emancipation.
But there was always this memory and this knowledge that there would be an attempt to restore slavery.
He had that, and he warned them. Anybody tells you to give up your guns, that means the restoration of slavery.
And so we come to many documents you have, writings of Toussaint and others. Perhaps, I remember you reading the first part, the prologue. I've underlined something here of your writings, Toussaint's writings. The underlining, the question is, are the colonists aware now that the black people will never return to that?
Toussaint is writing to the French government, and he's warning them that the colonists are plotting to restore slavery. And he's telling the French government, I'm somewhat uncertain as to what you intend to do. So he's telling them, well, I don't think you will. It is a very fine passage. Do they think that men who have been able to enjoy the blessing of liberty will calmly see it snatched away? They supported their chains only so long as they did not know any condition of life more happy than that of slavery. But today, when they have left it, if they had 1,000 lives, they would sacrifice them all rather than then be forced into slavery again. And then he speaks here to the French government, but no, the same hand which has broken our chains will not enslave us anew. France will not revoke her principles. She will not withdraw from us the greatest of her benefits. He's telling the French government, you wouldn't do it, but I'm telling you not to do it. She will protect us against all our enemies. She will not permit her sublime morality to be perverted. Those principles which do her most honor to be destroyed, her most beautiful achievement to be degraded. But if to reestablish slavery in San Domingo, this was done, then I declare to you, it would be to attempt the impossible. We have known how to face dangers to obtain our liberty. We shall know how to brave death to maintain it. And then he ends up magnificently. This, citizens, directors, is the morale of the people of San Domingo. These are the principles that they transmit to you by me. Orphe was beautiful.
The power and the eloquence.
Oh, yes.
And yet, wasn't this the one flaw in Toussaint, his faith in France? Coming to Toussaint Louverture's, possibly his one flaw, Dr. C.L.R. James, Professor James, our guest scholar, particularly on black African West Indian history, a reading talking about his book. It's a classic called The Black Jacobins, dealing with Toussaint Louverture revolt beginning in 1791 in San Domingo. And he was just reading one of the letters Toussaint wrote to France. In a moment, we return to the theme and to Professor James. We return to Professor James, his book, The Black Jacobins. He's just been reading a letter that Toussaint Louverture wrote to the French government, and we continue.
A flaw. I admit that it was a flaw, but to see it only as a flaw is a mistake, because that enabled him to lay the foundation in San Domingo that Dessalines and these others were able to use. That he had a limit. But it was this limitation that enabled him to establish something which the others could use.
I withdraw that word flaw, because this again is part of the power of your book, the nature of paradox, the nature of limitation, the nature of human possibilities. This was Toussaint.
I would like to tell you something. For 100 years and more, Toussaint was somewhat ignored in the history of San Domingo. People looked upon Toussaint as having made mistakes, and Dessalines as the man who carried the revolution to success, which undoubtedly he did. My book was translated into French. It went to Haiti. And I have been told by many Haitians that today in Haiti, there is a new conception of the role of Toussaint in the revolution due to the what my book has said.
So because even though, as you say, he was tied France very much.
Yes.
This enabled one of his colleagues, Dessalines,
to go further, but it enabled Toussaint to lay the foundation and to establish certain principles. The real mischief maker in that business was Bonaparte.
Ah, so now we come to Bonaparte misusing.
Bonaparte, who sent this tremendous expedition, perhaps the greatest expedition that had ever left Europe to conquer the Haitians, the blacks in San Domingo, and they failed.
You know, it's incredible. Again, the book and its 1969-70 counterparts. The greatest expedition to conquer an island. We think naturally of ourselves in Vietnam at the moment. But here it was, Leclerc led this incredible... Something happened to him, this French general, in his letters, his agony.
Yes.
Something he thought was easy, was a cinch.
Yes, no.
And then something happened to him.
And in the end he says, we in France have a false idea of the country in which we fight and the kind of men we fight against. That was Ronald to him at the end. He realized that the blacks of San Domingo were not people whom you could just drive into slavery. He says, we don't understand these people. I remember many passages of his letters, but I remember this passage in particular. It is not enough to have taken away Toussaint. There are 2,000 leaders in San Domingo to be taken away.
And right there, even though Toussaint was betrayed, he returned to France, he was imprisoned and died in prison. He said so, yeah, that there were still others.
Yes, he said, you have, in getting rid of me, you have taken away only the trunk of the tree, but its roots are deep, and slavery will never be restored in San Domingo. That must be remembered. Toussaint could take the chances that he did and tie himself to French civilization because he was absolutely certain that the slavery could never be restored.
And so it was 12 years or so.
Yes.
The French lost thousands, of course, the blacks.
They lost 60,000 men, and more than that, the historian of the British Army says that the British Army was destroyed in the Caribbean. Totally destroyed. He says that is why when the war began in 93, they made little attempt or could do little in regard to France, in regard to the army, in regard to military invasion of France. The reason was because they were attempting to capture the West Indian territories of France, and the black armies destroyed the British Army completely. Fortescue, the historian of the British Army, says that 1798 is the most disgraceful year in the history of the British Army, because those blacks in the San Domingo did what they did.
You know, your book has never-ending possibilities, because it occurs to me, the black Jacobins, and of course the phrase used with the French Revolutionary Party, the Jacobin Party, but also the role that the Toussaint Louverture Revolution played in the American Civil War.
Now, not only that, I would prefer to say this, it is in regard to the independence of the Latin American countries, because they saw America independent. Good, they accepted that. But then they saw these black slaves not only win the independence, but keep it. Whereupon a lot of them in Latin America began to say, well, if they could win the independence and keep it, it isn't only America and a big country like, so we can. And Pétion was beaten from Latin America, was welcomed in Haiti, he was given food, he was made better, doctors attended him, and then they gave him men.
This was a Latin American.
Latin America, they gave him men, they gave him arms, they gave him money, they gave him a printing press, and it is from there he went back to Latin America to win the independence of the five states. So they took a tremendous part in the development of Latin America.
Of Latin America, and then, of course, here we come to the United States.
Because the people in the United States refused to recognize Haiti until after 1865. Because the southern slave owners were always looking upon that as somewhere where they could expand the territorial development of cotton, number one, and number two. San Domingo and Haiti had given an example to the French, to the blacks in the United States, which they knew very well, and which these southern plantation owners were mightily afraid of. That was a tremendous role.
You know, again, the contemporary aspects of the book, toward the latter part of it, the War of Independence, the last chapter, you speak of the pride of, in 3 years, people ask, how could this happen in 3 years? This, any part of your own writing there?
If in 1788 anyone had told the Comte de Lausanne, the minister, the Comte de Pinier, the governor, General Rochambeau, the soldier, Moreau de Saint-Méry, the historian, Barbé de Marbois, the bureaucrat, that the thousands of dumb brutes who were whipped to labor at dawn and whipped back at midnight, who submitted to their mutilations, burnings, and other savageries, some of whom would not even move unless they were whipped, if these fine gentlemen had been told that in 3 years the blacks would shake off their chains and face extermination rather than put them on again, they would have thought the speaker mad. While if today one were to suggest to any white colonial potentate that among those blacks whom they rule are men so infinitely their superior in ability, energy, range of vision, and tenacity of purpose that in 100 years' time these whites would be remembered only because of their contact with the blacks, one would get some idea of what the counts, marquises, and other colonial magnates of the day thought of Jean-Francois, Toussaint and Rigaud when the revolt first began.
Thus again we come to the question of awareness and the lack of awareness on the other side of what is happening, of what is about to happen.
Yes.
Your book again has this prophetic quality. It's 1938 first written.
And many of these things are written in 1938. I didn't write them in. I made one or two changes and introduced one or two new points, but essentially 98% of the book is as it was. Now I would like, if you don't mind, to read this. This is one of my favorite passages in the book. Yes. And you must remember that this was written in 1938. He had sent millions of francs to America to wait for the day when he would be ready to invade Africa, put an end to the slave trade, and make millions of blacks free and French, as the French Revolution had made the blacks of San Domingo. The Great Revolution had propelled him out of his humble joys and obscure destiny, and the trumpets of its heroic period rang ever in his ears. In him, born a slave and the leader of slaves, the concrete realization of liberty, equality and fraternity was the womb of ideas and the springs of power which overflowed their narrow environment and embraced the whole of the world. But for the revolution, this extraordinary man and his band of gifted associates would have lived their lives as slaves, serving the commonplace creatures who owned them, standing barefooted and in rags to watch inflated little governors and mediocre officials from Europe pass by, as many a talented African stands in Africa today. I wrote that in 1938, and today I'm very proud of it, because I knew what was taking place. They were standing there in rags and having to wave when these fellows passed. And they only needed a few years for them to be driving past, in charge, whatever they did. And these fellows became nothing.
It is amazing, your passage, that as well as your book, Professor James, the fact that you describe this, and toward the end of it, you speak of a letter from a Rhodesian black that speaks of this particular aspect of it. Your writing, of course, the style, the power, but also the truth, that in this one man, then you saw the development of a people, too.
Yes.
And you spoke of the West Indians earlier, and of course, the great poet, Aimé Césaire, whom you know.
Yes, I know Césaire. He's a man I admire very much. And in the course of this appendix, in which I deal with the history of the West Indies from Toussaint Louverture to Fidel Castro, I refer to Césaire's great poem, Cahier d'un retour au pays natal, Statement of a Return to the Country Where I Was Born. And I've translated some of it, because it is in this poem that is first stated the poetic conception of negritude. He says, "My negritude is not a stone, its deafness a sounding board for the noises of the day. My negritude is not a mere spot of dead water on the dead eye of the earth. My negritude is no tower, no cathedral. It cleaves into the red flesh of the teeming earth. It cleaves into the glowing flesh of the heavens. It penetrates the seamless bondage of my unbending patience." And then he makes a tremendous statement on behalf of African civilization. Hurrah for those who never invented anything, for those who never explored anything, for those who never mastered anything, but who, possessed, give themselves up to the essence of each thing, ignorant of the coverings, but possessed by the pulse of things, indifferent to mastering, but taking the chances of the world. And then he launches an attack on white civilization in 1938, the same year I wrote this book. And today, with all these missiles about, he says, "Listen to the white world, its horrible exhaustion from its immense labors, its rebellious joints cracking under the pitiless stars, its blue steel rigidities, cutting through the mysteries of the flesh. Listen to their vainglorious conquests, trumpeting their defeats. Listen to the grandiose alibis of their pitiful floundering. But he says, I must not be hate. I must not have hate. He says, for it is not true that the work of man is finished, that man has nothing more to do in the world but be a parasite in the world, that all we now need is to keep in step with the world. But the work of man is only just beginning, and it remains to man to conquer all the violence entrenched in the recesses of his passion. And no race possesses the monopoly of beauty, of intelligence, of force. And there is a place for all at the rendezvous of victory. It is a magnificent poem. Oh, yes. This is the finest poem ever written on Africa.
You know, as
he's a West Indian, too, I want to say.
Professor C.L.R. James, as you just read these excerpts from the César poem, I couldn't help but think of the power, the humanity of it, and, of course, of your book and your scholarship. The book, by the way, for listeners who will be inquiring, it's vintage. It's a paperback vintage. It's definitely available. It's a classic, and it should be read, it seems to me, by anyone who wants to know about the open window and what is going on in the world and what will continue. And perhaps just one as sort of a postscript, your own courses, the way you teach, manner, all literature uses your base in speaking of liberation. And it's used in one of your courses, Origin of Western Civilization, from the Bible of the Hebrews, Revolt of Colonial People, Exodus, Revolt of Women Against Second-Class Citizenship, Esther. And you go on to speak of Greek, use Greek classics.
Yes.
And you go on.
I use the Greek classics because the basis of Western civilization is the work of the Hebrews and of the Greeks. Everybody understands that. So in studying the race and the radicalism of race, I take examples of the radicalism of the Hebrews and the radicalism of the Greeks. I am happy to do the story of Moses because he was the first that we know of who led a suppressed people to freedom. So if you're talking about freedom and the release of a suppressed people, I begin with Moses. That is what we are rooted in, particularly in the United States and in the Caribbean. We are rooted in Western civilization. So we cannot ignore African civilization. We do the best we can to be in contact with it. That series of talks, I deal with Mau Mau, I deal with Nkrumah, etc., the emergence of Africa. But I say we have to be aware of where we have come from. We cannot deny the roots of Western civilization and the radicalism that we find in it. We absorb and take it to ourselves. So that I think we have a lot to learn because we both Western and African civilization, we of the black people in the Caribbean and in the United States, we touch civilization at two points. And in all my work, I try to be aware of them.
Indeed, as also what Dr. Du Bois said, in Soul of Black
Folk. Dr. Du Bois is one of the greatest men of the 20th century. I have been very hostile to people who talk about Dr. Du Bois as one of the great black leaders. And even black people say, well, he was one of our best. I say, by doing that, you denigrate him. He was one of the most distinguished citizens of the 20th century. Black, white, yellow, or anything. A remarkable man.
Yes. So in Dr. James, we have the scholar. At the same time, not the academician, not the removed, detached, very much the advocate scholar.
Yes, I'm the advocate, and wherever possible, I participate in the struggles of the people. I know, and my course is aimed at proving that without the conscious intervention, or even the unconscious intervention of the mass of the people, there can be no real progress towards liberation. The intellectual may express and make clear what is really taking place in the majority of the people. That is what my course is seeking to put, and that is what my book, The Black Jacobins, expresses both for France and for the colonies.
Just as there are two cultures, just as you find the fusion of the two and the contribution of the black man to both, tremendous, so you all see knowledge, you all see activity from the scholar, but from the street as well, the book and the street, you see it going both ways.
Together, and one expresses the other, and the work of the book is of no serious value unless it is supplemented and stimulated by the work of the street. That is the view I have.
The Black Jacobins is the book, and it's my privilege indeed to have been here with Professor C.L.R. James, now visiting professor at Northwestern University. It's vintage. Thank you very much indeed.
Much obliged to you, sir. Much obliged to you.
This particular conversation took place during Dr. James' last day. in America. He returned to his home in London. He'll be returning to America soon to lecture at Princeton, at Yale, and at Columbia. We trust at Northwestern again, where he'd like to talk about the various literatures of history and liberation, Old Testament, New Testament, the Greeks. That was part of a series, too, at Northwestern. So we trust in the not-too-distant future once more. Dr. James will be our guest. The book is The Black Jacobins, paperback, vintage, the publishers. We thought perhaps some music that might be appropriate now, in the time remaining. There are songs, slave songs and code songs sung in the islands, San Domingo then, and no doubt many of them found their way in America itself, in the States, in the pre-Civil War days. A Voodoo American is such a song. It is code, as black spirituals are code. It's a funeral song, Via Baluco. At the same time, it speaks of freedom. And though it speaks of that body of water, when the burden of life becomes too much for the man who has died, there's a deep body of water separating him from freedom. So, as we say, this could be the River Jordan. It also could be that river separating slave from free state, or slave state from Canada. And these are songs that are commonly found today in the Sea Islands off the coast of Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina. It could be traced there, but I imagine could go back to the Caribbean as well. This one, Voodoo American.
And that was an interview with C.L.R. James, the Trinidadian-born historian and journalist, political activist, who spanned the spectrum of the 20th century. And that interview was done by Studs Terkel in 1970. And we'll take a break. We'll be back with our concluding segment.
All of ears will hear, and all of eyes will see. They will see, and they will hear.
It is good. Thank you.
Welcome back, and that was Burning Spear with the song entitled It Is Good, What a Man Can Think for Himself. And our concluding segment is a compilation of news reports from Africa and the international community from CGTN from earlier today. Let's listen in.
This is CGTN, China Global Television Network.
The UN warns hunger is expected to increase in 23 global hotspots. South Africa makes over $2.5 billion in relief available to individuals and businesses. And Botswana sends nearly 300 troops to Mozambique, Cabo Delgado, to help restore security there. Hello and welcome. You're watching Africa Live. We're coming to live from Nairobi. I'm Hannah Vivier. Here are more stories making headlines this hour. In business news, South Africa's public sector workers agree on terms averting strike action. And in your sport, boxer Samuel Tacky wins Ghana's first Olympic medal since 1992. We begin the hour on the issue of food insecurity. Hunger is expected to rise in 23 global hotspots in the next 3 months. That's according to the Food and Agriculture Organization, as well as the World Food Program. The two UN agencies say the highest alerts for catastrophic situations are for Ethiopia's embattled Tigray region, where the number of people facing starvation and death is expected to rise to over 400,000. Meanwhile, the southern part of Madagascar, which has been hit by the worst drought in the past 40 years, is also at risk. Also on the list is South Sudan and the northern part of Nigeria. The new report on hunger hotspots by the UN agencies indicates that acute food insecurity is likely to worsen in many other countries, including Yemen, Afghanistan, Burkina Faso, Kenya, the CAR, Haiti, and Syria. The report goes on to say that hunger is being driven mostly by conflict dynamics as well as the impact of COVID-19, which includes food price hikes, rising inflation, a significant decrease in purchasing power, and various complications with harvesting seasons. Well, for more on this report, we're joined by CGTN's Giram Chala in Addis Ababa, Patrick Ayet, who's in Juba, Tassim Akende, who's in Jos, Nigeria, and Nick Madimbo's right here in Nairobi, Kenya. Let's start with you, Giram. Thank you, first of all. Thank you so much to all of you for joining us. Giram, let's start with you in Addis. The situation in Ethiopia has been called catastrophic by this UN report. Could you give us an indication or an update of what is happening, particularly in the Tigray region, and what some of the efforts that are being made there?
Well, it's been more than 9 months now since the conflict in the northern part of Ethiopia began. What the government started as a law enforcement mission turned out to be a war between the force in the Tigray region and the Ethiopian National Defense Force. After 9 months, the result is a lot of human casualties. Humanitarian situation in that regional state is now close to being catastrophic, according to the United Nations. At the moment, war, unfortunately, is continuing in different locations in the Tigray regional state, and understandably why sufferings of people are also continuing. Millions of people are now in need of food services, and many also have crossed borders to Sudan looking for shelter and security at the same time. The good news, perhaps, is now roundtable discussions in order to resolve the conflict peacefully are coming to the forefront. Different organizations, including the United Nations and governments, are also requesting for this peaceful negotiation to resolve the situation in the north. But however, the problem is humanitarian access is still a problem, and people's suffering is continuing. The hope is in the next few days things will change now that the UN is engaging the government and TPLF force in the north.
Thank you so much for that, Gurum. Let's come to you, Patrick, in Juba. The report says that famine was most likely happening in parts of Pibor and was expected to continue. Patrick, what are the likely causes of such extreme hunger in some parts of South Sudan, and how is the government dealing with it?
Hannah, first of all, we were in Pibor about 2 weeks ago. We saw the situation is really alarming. Many women are really suffering. They have young children who are malnourished. These children do not have anything to feed on. You find the woman's breast milk is only coming water, is not nutritious. They are admitted in the hospital. Yes, coming to your question of what are the causes, the main cause here is violence, because in as much as the 2018 peace agreement ended 6 years of war, many of the residents returned to their own homes to try to begin farming. But the delay in formation of a new government designed by that peace agreement meant there was a power vacuum in the local government. Armed youth took advantage, raiding communities, so it displaced people. So the little food they had planted remained, and then it followed by relentless rain in 2019 and 2020, flooding in most parts of the country. The little crops that were grown were washed away, livestock washed away, people remain in internally displaced camps. No food, depending on humanitarian agencies for food. And of course, the government now is saying the only thing it's doing is to actually ensure that there is peace, to allow the humanitarian agencies to reach the people in need, because now the government itself does not have money. Even civil servant salaries are being paid in bits. There are still a lot of areas that they are supposed to cover. So to get money to provide any humanitarian services is really very difficult. And also, of course, the aid agencies are also complaining, because even now rain has started again and some parts of northern part of the country is flooding. So getting to those areas with food aid is extremely difficult. So the situation really is still continuing to deteriorate. The government has started providing some kind of farm inputs like hoes and ox plows. But this, of course, many say it will not help unless total peace returns to the country and the issue of flooding is addressed, Hannah.
Thank you so much for that, Patrick. Let's head over to Nigeria now, where Tassem Akinde is standing by for us. Tassem, what are some of the main causes of extreme hunger in some parts of Nigeria? And if you could please speak to us about how insurgency is contributing to food insecurity in northern Nigeria and how the authorities are responding.
Well, northern Nigeria is known for its arable nature. The land is good and it's good for agriculture. So the insurgency has taken a bad toll on the food situation generally. The United Nations in a report earlier this year brought about an estimated 350,000 people to have been killed as a result of this insurgency. Many of them were farmers. And about 2 million of those people are still in internally displaced camps at the moment. Now, this has far-reaching effect because many of these people have been farmers over time. They've been displaced from their ancestral lands where their mainstay had always been agriculture. So this has really affected their livelihoods and, by extension, the entire country and perhaps to say the entire African continent as well, because most of what they were doing was not just for local consumption here in Nigeria, most of their agricultural products. So there's some far-reaching effect to that. Many of them are still, internally displaced, about 2 million of them, according to the United Nations. About 300,000 children are malnourished at the moment as we speak. That's according to the United Nations as well. So it's a very sad situation. And over to what the government is doing. The government has launched several initiatives, one of which is to, give out improved seedlings to farmers who can at least farm at the moment. North Central Nigeria is really affected by the farmer-herder clashes as well, which is also worsening the food situation at the moment. But with these improved seedlings, for at least those who can farm, this is to boost the agricultural produce. Talking about what the government is doing as well, we'd like to let you know that the military at the moment is launching several operations to ensure that these people, more territories are recovered from insurgents, so that those who are actually displaced at the moment and taking refuge in internally displaced camps return to their mainstay, which is agriculture, and by extension to have the situation improved. These are what is going on. But really, the situation is pretty bad, but the government is also trying to have these people back to their sources of livelihood and by extension their ancestral lands.
Thank you so much for that, Tassim. Let's head over now right here in Nairobi, Kenya. Nick, what is the state of food insecurity here in Kenya and how is the government dealing with it?
Absolutely, Hannah. Thank you very much. And in Kenya, it's no different from other African countries. And it's a bit hectic for farmers. They're grappling with so much currently. And of course, the consistent, unpredictable rain patterns is really actually messing up their plants. I was in Eldoret, that's Kenya's Rift Valley, some 2 weeks ago. And we noticed that many farmers currently are actually shifting from even growing the maize crop to other crops. And of course, right now, they're focusing on what they'll actually put on the table to feed their families. And of course, you know that agriculture is actually the food basket of the country. It's been difficult for many farmers also, the fact that now the climatic changes is very unpredictable for them. They just hope that indeed the rain patterns will be consistent for them to continue growing the crops they've been growing over time. But right now they're grappling with a lot of issues. And the government is actually coming in swiftly in this case. They're actually giving the farmers subsidized fertilizers for them to now prepare for the new planting season. But at the moment, things are not really looking good for the farmers. Also, the government is now training farmers in terms of now climatic changes. They need to be aware of what is happening in the world because not all the farmers are actually aware that indeed so many things are happening in terms of climatic changes that is affecting their returns. And they're spending so much in terms of production cost just to make sure that their harvest is consistent. But this time around in Kenya, things are a bit very bad. And of course, in the northern part of Kenya, things are also looking bad. The drought situation is looming big time. And the government also is now trying to mobilize its resources to make sure they also come in and, of course, sort out the people suffering. Also, something else, Hannah, is that in Kenya, as much as they talk about highlands where many farmers actually grow crops, it's been very unfortunate because many farmers are actually abandoning agriculture and they're going to real estate. They're using the land actually to build houses for commercial purposes. So it's not very different from, of course, other African countries, but in Kenya, the situation is really bad. Now, catapulted also by the COVID-19 situation, many are not really comfortable just to go out there and, of course, do their daily chores. But it's very cumbersome right now. And as I've mentioned, COVID-19 has worsened things. Back to you.
Thank you so much for all that, Nick. Those were our correspondent, CGTN, Zagiram Chala, who was in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia for us. Patrick Uyet was speaking to us from Juba, South Sudan. Tassim Makende was in Jos, Nigeria. And Nick Madimba right here in our newsroom at CGTN here in Nairobi, Kenya. Well, let's turn our attention to Somalia now, where herders are facing an uncertain future there, which some experts attribute to the effects of climate change as well as conflict, which has left communities struggling to survive. CGTN's Daniel Arab Moy reports.
Herders in Somalia are facing multiple crises. Unpredictable weather patterns, droughts and floods have taken a toll on pastoralists, threatening their only livelihoods, their livestock. Conflict, the COVID-19 pandemic and recent locust invasions have compounded the effects of an already dire situation.
We lost 50 animals. There were 70. 50 died and we were left with 20 camels. Some no longer have livestock, they lost them all. That's how it is and we are surviving.
Only God knows, but we wonder whether our way of life is in danger. If the droughts continue and the animals get fewer, then this way of life is in real danger. That is our fear.
Herds are dwindling as pasture for the animals become harder to find.
Somalia is located in East Africa, the Horn of Africa, that is known to be, in terms of global warming, 2.5 times faster than the rest of the world. This has brought extreme weather events. These extreme weather events due to global warming, climate change, are droughts, floods, cyclones.
Recovery for the communities is becoming more difficult to envision.
the climate change combination has been worsened by an exceptional situation of coronavirus. When coronavirus came, the first consequence was the closure of the borders. And Somalia depends a lot in terms of import of goods, but also exporting livestock to the Arab.
According to the United Nations, climate-related hazards in Somalia have increased threefold in the past decades. Conflict has led to the internal displacement of some 2.9 million people. The lives of many Somalis depend on humanitarian efforts to support them while they try to rebuild what has been lost. Daniel Arap Moy, CGTN.
Let's head over to South Africa now, where thousands of businesses there are trying to rebuild following the recent wave of unrest. The government has made available over $2.5 billion in relief to enterprises and individuals have lost everything. Acts of looting and arson engulfed the country following the jailing of former President Jacob Zuma. CGTN's Julie Shaya gives us the details.
Mohammed and Zuraida Sahib could do little to save their Durban-based textile factory when it was looted and burnt in the recent social unrest.
So when I got into my premises, then it really hit me. God, this is gone. I thought maybe we would have something left over, like maybe the machinery, but there wasn't a single stitch that could be taken and, you know, reused, because it's like they've taken away everything. From machinery to equipment to everything. So that was very, very hard sore, because it was 27 years of hard work.
The couple started ZA Gear in 1994 with $1.50, some fabric and a sewing machine. It quickly grew into a thriving operation, employing 150 people and training dozens of others.
So they would come out with a diploma and a degree. We'd take them on as interns, and we used to train lots of sewing machine operators. So we had lots of young people that we needed quality controllers, we needed sewing machine operators, and then we had lots of young men that we used to teach them how to do cutting. So they used to do the cutting of the garments.
As the Saibs walk through the ruins, they realize it will take a lot more to build this time. They hope there will be considered in the state's $2.5 billion relief package.
What we need for this business to start up and running urgently is that we at least need all our machinery. We need a premises, we need the resources, we need a bit of working capital to give us a boost a bit from government, because we want to get this plant moving.
But they're eager to restart and have moved their operations home.
I have a huge plan in that I'm very positive in the sense that I know that there's a lot more to come. And I mean, people need food and people need clothes. Right? So we are lucky that we are in this industry. Our order books are now full. And we're ready for August, September, October, November.
It's going to be a tough task rebuilding this economy. Tens of thousands of businesses were obliterated in the unrest. The hard work starts now for many small enterprises who are hoping that they can survive this ordeal. Julie Shara, CGTN, Cape Town, South Africa.
Uganda has received over 500,000 doses of COVID-19 vaccines to help deal with the coronavirus. The doses are a donation from the Chinese and Norwegian governments. The East African country has only managed to vaccinate 5% of its targeted population, Leon Sinyanga reports.
300,000 doses of the Sinovac vaccines are a donation from the Chinese government. The addition of the Sinovac vaccine is expected to help the country speed up its inoculation program.
The pandemic is a common enemy and a common challenge to the mankind and to each one of us. The virus really knows no border. To bring pandemic under control requires unity, solidarity, cooperation, and common action.
Another 286,008 doses of AstraZeneca donated by the Norwegian government will supplement the country's campaign. The vaccines arrived hours after the lifting of a 42-day national lockdown. The opening up follows a remarkable reduction in COVID-19 cases,
from 1,735 cases at the peak in June to as low as 71 daily cases at the end of July.
Speed and equitable access to COVID-19 vaccines in all countries is the key to combating the COVID-19 pandemic. The government of Uganda has handled the pandemic very well, but we recognize now the challenging situation Uganda is currently facing.
Uganda has so far administered over 1.1 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. The ministry is also planning to include children aged between 12 and 18 years in its vaccination plan as it seeks to hit its target of inoculating 22 million Ugandans by next year.
The program will also begin quantifying that group, and soon the 22 million people will be expanded. The only way we can all return back to what seems to be normalized is after vaccination and observance of the standard operating procedures.
The government says some 2 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccines it ordered will arrive in August. Uganda has so far registered more than 93,000 COVID-19 cases since March last year.
Another 1.6 million doses of the Pfizer and AstraZeneca vaccines are expected this September. Those officials say will cater for more than 800,000 people as Uganda moves to accelerate its vaccination program and contain the spread of the coronavirus. Leon Senyange, CGTN, Kampala, Uganda.
Well, Kenya's efforts to ensure that at least 10 million people are vaccinated before December have received a major boost following the arrival of additional vaccines from the UK. The Kenyan government has welcomed the donation, saying it was timely as the country continues to battle the coronavirus. Here's TGTN's Nick Mudimba with more.
The 4,000 doses of AstraZeneca vaccines donated by the UK government arrived at the Jomo Kenyatta International Airport in Nairobi on Saturday afternoon. Kenya's Minister of Health halted the issuance of the first AstraZeneca dose towards the end of May after experiencing challenges in supply chain, restricting the available doses to giving the second dose to those who had already received the first.
This consignment could not have come at a better time, particularly when we're in a robust campaign to vaccinate our people against COVID-19, a disease that has caused untold suffering not only to Kenyans, but to the entire world.
To attain herd immunity, Kenya is supposed to vaccinate at least 60% of the population. The government of Kenya is currently prioritizing second doses of health workers, teachers, other essential workers, and people aged over 58. Kenya had vaccinated close to 1.7 million people by the end of July.
This is the first of two deliveries we'll be making. This is a bilateral donation, and we're also sending some through the COVAX system, of which we're great supporters. So we'll be sending 817,000 doses, hopefully in the next week or so. And we're looking forward to these vaccines, which are here behind me today, reaching the Kenyan population who need them during the course of next week.
Through bilateral donations, Kenya expects to receive 1.7 million doses of Pfizer vaccines from the US government, 235,000 doses of AstraZeneca jab from Greece, and another 55,000 doses of AstraZeneca from Latvia. Nick Mudimba, CGTN, Nairobi, Kenya.
Let's take a look at what's happening over in the US, which registered over 100,000 daily coronavirus cases on a Friday, its highest since February. Health officials there say hospitalizations and deaths are increasing across the country. They say the Delta variant is largely to blame for the surge and are urging vaccinated people to wear masks in public indoor places. Meanwhile, millions of people who rent their homes are at risk of being forced from their homes as pandemic-related bans on residential evictions are set to expire. Toby Muse reports.
At midnight Saturday, federal protection preventing some evictions is set to come to an end, putting millions of Americans at risk of being evicted. To give an idea of the scale of the problem, according to the Census Bureau's most recent survey, 3.6 million Americans expressed some concern that they could be evicted in the next 2 months. The moratorium was first introduced last year as one of a number of measures to stabilize a hemorrhaging economy, including stimulus checks and enhanced unemployment benefits. Homeless shelters are now preparing for what could be a surge in new arrivals starting Monday. The idea of people cramped together in these homeless centers is particularly worrying given the recent growth in new cases of the coronavirus. Congress had made available $47 billion in rental assistance to help people behind with their rent, but local governments have only distributed around $3 billion of that. Critics say the red tape has made it difficult for people to get access to the funds. The eviction moratorium has been extended a few times in the past, but crucially rent payments have not been forgiven, but delayed, so some families who may have lost their jobs during the pandemic could be on the hook for thousands of dollars in back rent. Some states like California and New York have their own moratoriums on evictions that will continue. This issue has caused a rare note of discord between congressional Democrats and the White House, who up to this point have largely been on the same page during the presidency of Joe Biden. On Thursday, the White House said that because of an earlier Supreme Court ruling, it could not unilaterally extend the moratorium. It urged Congress to act, just as Congress was about to go on summer break. Democrats scrambled Friday to try to get a deal together, all to no avail. Some Democrats blamed the White House for springing it on them at the last moment. One Democrat of the progressive wing of the party spent the night sleeping on the steps of the Capitol Friday to protest the government's inaction. Toby Muse reporting for CGTN Washington.
Let's not take a short break and return. More news making headlines, including Tunisian President Kais Saied rejects accusations of staging a coup. And Botswana sends nearly 300 troops to Cabo Delgado.
Africa is a continent of diversity, with varied climates and enchanting geography, and a people so distinct, but with a shared enduring spirit. We are at the heart of the continent to bring you the untold stories.
Let's have a look.
We celebrate Africa as it shapes its own destiny.
I'm in Shirishi, Tunis, Cairo,
Syria,
Juba,
Ethiopia,
Tanzania.
Africa Live. Find your voice.
Welcome back. You're watching News Making Headlines right here on Africa Live. Botswana has sent nearly 300 troops to Mozambique. They join soldiers from the regional bloc Southern African Development Community. Troops from South Africa and Rwanda are already in Cabo Delgado. They are part of a mission to help Mozambique fight the growing Islamist insurgency. Well, we continue with that story. We're now joined by Chidi Nwano, Defense and Security Analyst at Pekavi Consulting, which is based in London. Thank you so much for joining us, Abide. Rwanda, a non-member of SADC, has sent troops to Mozambique. How is this being received?
Oh, good day, and thank you for having me. I think your reception depends on who you ask. So the Mozambican opposition parties have obviously been quite opposed to the deployment. Mozambique has quite a long history of foreign intervention, going back to the days of the Civil War, from the South Africans and the Russians, the Cubans, and all of the parties that more or less use Mozambique as a proxy battlefield. So there is a fairly negative history of foreign involvement, which kind of bites with all Mozambicans. But I think the population of Cabo Delgado will be just quite happy for any kind of assistance that's coming in. And the Rwandans are, you know, quite well-trained, quite experienced, and have, you know, good experience of counterinsurgency. So I think from the perspective of the Mozambican population in Cabo Delgado, this is quite welcome. But if you look at the political elite, this is seen as a fairly divisive move, not only because Parliament wasn't consulted, but because Rwanda is not even part of SADC. So this looks like a unilateral move by Frelimo and the President.
Well, just speak to us, other than Rwanda, the other nations that are going to be in Mozambique are considered, and they are foreign troops. How is that being received?
Well, it's a slightly different dynamic as this is a SADC deployment, and many of these countries already have some sort of a history with Mozambique. So Zimbabwe, which will be deploying troops, for many years during the 80s, deployed troops into Mozambique to defend, the railways. South Africa has a very mixed history, obviously, in Mozambique. But they're familiar. They're the regional superpower, the regional hegemon. So everyone expects South Africa to step up. Other powers such as Botswana and Namibia, they have less of a controversial history, but they also have fairly good, but small, competent militaries. So I think the mood is much more positive. I think the biggest issue there is more in the delay in the deployment and, the questions about its sustainability. South Africa obviously has its own internal issues, and South Africa is the kind of linchpin around which all of this is built around. And if South Africa can't sustain this effort, then it's unlikely that the other countries can sustain a major effort by themselves.
Chidi, we've seen this happen in various parts of the continent when it comes to insurgency, that sometimes what happens is that it spills over crosses borders into the rest of the region. So just speak to us about how this situation in Mozambique could impact stability within the SADC region.
Well, I think it's already having an impact. I mean, in Tanzania, in particular, there's a lot of cross-border issues, not just in terms of the violence or in terms of people from Tanzania, crossing into to join the rebels or fight with the rebels, but in terms of the disruption of the economy, the illegal mining and all the other kind of economic activities or illegal economic activities that surround insurgencies or ungoverned spaces. And at the same time, you've got the disruption that comes from the inability of Mozambique to exploit its gas fields from, the Total, declaring force majeure and all the other things associated with that. Now, that would have had a good impact on the regional economy. So all of these things put together, it's no longer a Mozambican problem. It's definitely a regional problem. And the contagion that would come if, this group is successful and can influence, other groups within the SADC region. South Africa has a significant Islamic population. It has a small but fairly vocal, Islamic extremist sector as well that could be influenced by this. So it's in everyone's interest to kind of keep this under control, contain it to Mozambique, and hopefully wipe it out before it spreads.
Chidi, thank you so much for joining us on the program. Abide Chidi, an international defense and security expert, and he's based in London. And moving on to North Africa, Tunisia has undergone massive political transformations in the past week. President Kais Saied has sacked the country's prime minister, frozen parliament, and assumed executive powers. These are just among some of the sweeping measures he's put in place. Adnan Chiwashi tells us more.
This is the main street of Habib Bourguiba Avenue in downtown Tunis. This area was paralyzed last week due to the protests as well as tight security measures. Now people have resumed a normal life. The curfew has been shortened from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. starting this Sunday, following a presidential decree issued by the head of state. Meanwhile, the four governors of the Greater Tunis District, which is made up of four governors, namely Tunis, Ariana, Manouba and Benarous, decided to put an end to the measures regarding the ban on vehicle traffic during weekends and on the intercity travel ban. Two members of parliament were arrested for incidents which took place before the July 25th presidential decision. The Ennahda Islamic movement said it rejects any prosecution of MPs before military courts and their imprisonment. A group of the Ennahda youths have signed a petition calling for the resignation of Ennahda leader and parliament speaker Rashid Ghannouchi and his executive bureau. President Kais Saied declared that despite the current crisis, Tunisia remains concerned about guaranteeing and defending rights and freedoms and acting in strict compliance with the constitution. Adnan Chiwashi, CGTN.
Meanwhile, Tunisia's regional partners are closely following the unfolding political crisis. On Saturday, Egypt and Algeria's foreign ministers discussed the situation. Egypt's foreign minister expressed support for President Saied. Meanwhile, Tunisia's president's critics accuse him of attempting to establish a dictatorship. President Saeed, however, denies the allegations, insisting that his actions are needed to fulfill demands made by the Tunisian people.
We are following with great interest what the Tunisian authority is doing in order to accomplish security, stability and the sovereignty of Tunisia, and we completely trust the wisdom and ability of the political leadership in Tunisia and its ability to manage the situation, to fulfill the demands and aspirations of the Tunisian people, and as the Algerian minister said, it is a Tunisian internal affair.
Let's head over to the Mediterranean, where western Greece has had huge wildfires which have forced evacuations and raids through forests to reach the shoreline. It broke out on Saturday in the hills east of Patras, the nation's third largest city. Helicopters, planes and over 140 firefighters are battling the blaze. It's not the only wildfire currently in Greece. Authorities say that more than 50 have been reported across the country. Evangelos Tsipras has more from Athens.
The Ministry of Citizen Protection has issued a warning to all Greek citizens and tourists to avoid any unnecessary work or travel, saying that there is a high risk of wildfires during the dangerous heat wave that is expected to peak early next week. The Hellenic National Meteorological Service has issued warnings for most of the country, with temperatures expected to rise above 40 degrees Celsius, climbing as high as 45 early next week. This is Greece's third bout of extreme heat this summer and could be the most severe. Many here in Athens have been seeking respite from the scorching weather, heading to air-conditioned centers or water fountains, while others went to nearby beaches hoping to cool down. But what worries authorities the most is the possibility of wildfires. That's why they order additional fire patrols and infrastructure maintenance inspections, while also urging people to show the highest degree of responsibility and cooperation.
We are all obligated to be extremely vigilant and avoid activity that could cause a wildfire, which will lead to catastrophic consequences. We kindly ask all citizens to avoid any activity in nature that could cause harm.
Earlier this week, people in the Stamata area, 30 kilometers north of Athens, were evacuated from the area after fires ripped through the pine forest, destroying their homes and cars before firefighters could bring the fire under control. Several parts of Greece are now on high alert. And although wildfires and heat waves are a common phenomenon here in Greece during the summer, authorities say that climate change is rising the risk of fires. Evangelos Tsipras for CGTN, Athens, Greece.
The business news after the break. Here's what you can expect. South Africa's public sector workers agree on terms averting strike action. And more people in rural areas in Nigeria tap into mobile money technology.
It's new, it's different, it's a challenge.
It's really exciting.
Time now for the business news. 60% of South Africa's public sector members, represented by four majority labor unions, signed a wage deal this week. This is after negotiations that had dragged on for over 3 months. The public sector workers finally agreed on a new wage deal averting strike actions. Dimitri Naidu has the details.
Four labor unions representing nurses, teachers and government administrators were demanding in the region of 8%. but finally agreed to take a 1.5% increase.
We had to compromise quite a bit. If you look at our initial demands and where we ended up, I think there is a great difference. But looking at the current economic climate and what has happened over the last 2 weeks or so, that it would be in the interest of all public servants that we should sign the agreement.
The 1.5% is way below inflation, but it is more than what the government can afford. In the 2019-2020 financial year, $41 billion was spent on public worker salaries. South Africa's 1.2 million public service workers, and the Treasury is spending a third of the country's budget to pay them.
The agreement was anticipated, and I say this because the negotiations have been going for quite a while, and I do not think any party wanted it to a possible strike.
The PSA represents over 230,000 members. Agreeing to this deal is a major win for government, but the latest wage deal will only be in place for a year. South Africa's unions usually negotiate three-year wage deals. Last year, government went against this policy due to COVID and the massive financial impact it had on the economy.
It's a shorter period. We are going to demand in future, taking lessons from what happened last year, that we will be negotiating annual salary agreement, unless we can get a multi-term that is satisfied to all our members.
It's understandable that unions in the space, in the public sector, are cautious and prefer now a one-year agreement. It's going to be tricky. 3 years have always given a sense of security. If it's going to be happening yearly, that's going to change the dynamics of collective bargaining.
The unions are still fighting government on its failure to honour the last three-year wage deal, but the courts ruled in favour of the finance ministry. However, the Constitutional Court is preparing to make its ruling.
This may be a win for government, but this wage deal is important to all South Africans. Any strike action at this stage would have added to the trauma of recent events. Sabitha Nadi, CGTN, Johannesburg, South Africa.
The adoption of mobile money in Nigeria has not seen the kind of rapid progress the country's central bank had predicted when it was launched 10 years ago. However, some progress has been made as more people in rural areas tap into the technology. Here's CGTN's Deji Badmos with more on that story.
Olamide Haruno is one of the more than 20 million mobile money customers in Nigeria. Thanks to the rollout of the mobile money initiative, she's able to send, receive and save money at this roadside mobile money shop in the Nigerian commercial capital of Lagos. Before she resorted to the use of mobile money, she would need to go to a bank to carry out the transactions.
Well, I think using mobile banking is easy, is fast, and it saves stress. Rather than going to the bank to queue and all that, so you rather just go there once and for all.
Mobile money shops like this are now becoming common sights in Lagos and across the country. The Central Bank of Nigeria is hoping to leverage the initiative to achieve financial inclusion for the country's 38 million unbanked adult population. There are more than 20 licensed mobile money operators in Nigeria, including banks, with hundreds of thousands of agents providing the service to clients across the country. This also includes clients who are already in the banking system.
You know, in the entire value chain, there are a lot of players. So, you know, the value in it beyond, you know, fostering transactional services between players, also you would see that, you know, there are people who are actively employed by the people that are in that value chain. So there is the employment and there is, you know, trade.
Nigeria still lags behind some of its African peers in the adoption of mobile money. But the numbers are growing rapidly. As of January last year, the volume of mobile payments in the country topped 7.4 million transactions, up from just over 700,000 in 2019. In the vast rural areas of Nigeria, mobile money services are quickly becoming the main means of sending, receiving or even saving money.
One of the things that I foresee, or that, you know, would be a huge deal breaker, especially on the economic growth side of things, is, you know, a world where we can then start to push cross-border transactions through mobile money.
With internet penetration rapidly expanding in Nigeria, in addition to its huge unbanked population, the prospects for growth of mobile money in Africa's largest economy look bright, and experts say it's only a matter of time before it becomes the leading player on the continent.
If you look at the numbers, scratch the percentage, if you look at the actual numbers in terms of, you know, how many of our banks people are actually having access to financial services, I would say that we're not too far off from some of our counterparts in other African countries.
The Central Bank of Nigeria recently issued additional comprehensive guidelines to further regulate mobile money services in the country. The Apex Bank says it is still confident that ultimately mobile money will help make the difference in its financial inclusion campaign. Deji Badmus, CGTN, Lagos, Nigeria.
Well, it's time for a short break. Here's what's still to come. We bring you a story of how Kenyan women in an informal settlement are making soap and masks to fight COVID-19.
The greatest journeys. The greatest sights. The greatest adventures.
Here in Panathur, this weir allows the...
Welcome back. And that was a series of news reports from CGTN, from the Africa Live program. And that's going to conclude the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, August the 1st, and the early morning hour of Monday, August 2nd, 2021. We've been broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to have access to this program, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And if you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire, all you need to do is go to the panafricannews.blogspot.com. We're going to close out with the music of Kenny Burrell, entitled All Day Long from 1957. Burrell just celebrated his 90th birthday, Detroit's own Kenny Burrell. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.